Test Talks, Episode 2.
Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things software test automation. I'm your host, Joe from joecolantonio.com, and today we're going to be geeking out on Selenium with Dave Hefner, the author of the new book, The Selenium Guidebook, How to Use Selenium Successfully. Check it out. I think today is going to be an awesome episode because I'm talking with Dave Hefner about Selenium test automation. Dave is the author of the excellent new book, The Selenium Guidebook, the founder of Argyle, a QA consultancy, and he's a very active member and contributor to the Selenium community. Hey, Dave, welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So, Dave, before we get started, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I guess the easy path to take is I never intended to start out doing testing. I didn't really know what it was. I used to do IT operations. I have a background in data networking, network engineering. And I used to do a lot of help desk systems, server administration, and user support. And then I got bored, I guess. I was at a company that lateral movements were pretty awesome and easy and encouraged. And so there was an opening in QA, and it looked like they could use the help. They were doing a lot of manual testing, and they were just trying to get started with some automation, and they were using Selenium IDE. And I just kind of shadowed. It was funny. It was like the person who was in charge of the department's like, just shadow some of these QAs and then let me know how it goes. And so I shadowed them and I said, it was pretty good. I'm interested. And he's like, I had the impression that it was going to be like a trial run. Yep. And then next thing I know, it was official. I was now a QA and I was like, wait, what happened to the trial run? I guess the shadowing was the trial run. But, it was interesting at the time where, there was fairly, people that were new to automation, like, I don't want to call them non-technical because they were technical people. The people can understand complicated things, but they just didn't have experience with development or any sort of automation. And so they were doing their best and they were like, bartering, stealing from developers to try to get help. And what would happen was, there would be this black box of code that would be given down to the test team. And it was, written in, it was basically an executable binary that was some sort of byproduct of whatever code was written. And when you ran it, it did exactly what the testers wanted, but as soon as they wanted to modify it, there wasn't a lot of room for growth there. And so at the time, we had an intern who was really into Ruby. This is like 5 years ago. And so I said, hey, we have these problems that need to be solved. It looks like Ruby can solve them. And so I don't consider myself a developer, but I started writing a lot of code. And then kind of fast forward, after building a couple of frameworks within the Fool, this is the Motley Fool. Yep. And then I ended up, leaving and starting my own company and started doing training and, framework consulting and process consulting and a whole bunch of stuff with other companies and then I co-wrote an open source framework for Selenium called Chemistry Kit. And I realized over time, like every client was pretty much asking for the same things, wanted the same questions answered, and so I wrote them down and that's my book. So
awesome. Yeah, so how did you make that leap from working full time for a company to going into consultancy within 5 years?
Well, I guess I always had this want to kind of go out on my own. I mean, there's like a long line of entrepreneurs in my family. I just kind of grew up surrounded by small business entrepreneurs. I mean, I'm from a small town in upstate New York, and it seems like there's a lot of, my friends' parents had like small mom and pop shops, and my dad, ended up, he was a journalist for decades and started his own newspaper, his own online hyperlocal newspaper, and he's been doing that for 10 years.
Cool.
And he's been successful at it. And even before then, he was like selling stuff on eBay, and like it was just like making a go of it with technology. And the other, I guess the lightning in the bottle one is my grandfather invented the world's first non-lethal bullet, and you know made millions. And it's just kind of like, I don't know, it just seemed like I had this built up like uncoordinated enthusiasm about doing, like, this energy for doing things that weren't as interesting or were more interesting as what I was working on. It was like I was doing, you know, I was doing this one thing for a company, but I could do this for many companies, and I could help more people. And I started to basically realize that kind of more from like a, not like a mission statement, but more just like a feeling of purpose around, I think that technology can really help people achieve more, a lot more. And I think that you just have to figure out how to leverage computers to do what they're good at, so you could free up humans to do, let them do what they're good at. And so with that kind of heading, it was like, oh, well, I could totally like go and help people do that. And so it was just a matter of finding the first one, because I had like a 6-month runway, and I didn't leave with the intention of doing QA. I actually left with the intention of like stepping away from QA, because I was like kind of, I felt burnt out. And I was going to focus on consulting for doing tech stuff for small businesses, helping them like grow their business. But that was completely different than I had anticipated for a large number of reasons. And so then I made some phone calls, and I was like, I contacted some old colleagues, and then magically I was like 2 weeks later in Costa Rica training a software development team. It was like, it was very surreal.
Awesome. That's yeah. Awesome.
So then after that, I was like, oh, I'll do QA. And then I had this evolution over time. Like, I was doing traditional style trainings where, you know, we'd sit with a team and do like 2 days fire hose with information, and then potentially come back in like 4 or 6 weeks to see how they're doing, like a doctor's visit. But I really felt like there's a lot of waste in that model. There's a lot of room for improvement where people get a bunch of information and they maybe retain 20% of it, and then probably get to use 5% of it, unless it's something that's like absolutely directly relevant to what they're doing. So I just felt like the stuff that I was trying to teach was really worth doing. And so that's why I felt like moving away from training and more towards kind of a concierge model for the consulting clients I do, where, like, for example, right now, my current client, I'm there for 2 weeks on site for the initial kickoff. And then after that, I'm part-time. And then at that point, like when we start to wind down, like I'm still available almost like on a retainer model, but I'm not implementing things for them. I'm helping them figure out how to implement things. Whereas in the past, I've been asked to just write the code and hand it over. That model doesn't work as well. And it's just getting the team involvement, getting business involvement, and then working alongside them and helping them come to those realizations, as opposed to me just telling them that this is what they should do, which is effectively what the training was and what it felt like. And I feel like this model works a lot better. And that's kind of, I guess, my hope in the way I wrote the book is kind of like that. Maybe those epiphanies unfold. Granted, it's a book and I have to force my opinion into it in order to make it flow and be concise. But it's also a good teaching aid. So,
excellent. So I guess that was my next question. So what was the main reason for you writing the Selenium guidebook?
Well, there's two reasons. One is I had this idea for a long time. The simple thought I always have in my head, I have this image of a chasm, and this started back when I started doing QA. I realized that there's a chasm, and on one side there's everybody that's trying to learn how to use Selenium and get started with testing. And then on the other side are the experts who already know how to do this stuff, which are likely the ones who built it. And in the middle is this big void that is filled with tons of solutions and poor documentation that are like kind of half solving the real problem. And what I realized over time is it's not a technological problem. It's an information problem. In order to easily create a bridge to cross from one side of the chasm to the other, you need to know like how to navigate the terrain and actually find information on your own. And it was a very lengthy and challenging process to go from knowing nothing about testing and test automation and Selenium to being able to effectively do it for company after company and write a book about it. So I felt that enormous pain, and I really felt when I started that was a pain that needed to be solved, but I didn't know how to solve it. And then now looking back, with what I know, I figure the best I could do was write the book I wish existed when I started. And it seems well-timed because what's happening now is the industry, specifically people who have been in the community for a while, in the Selenium community, and the core committers are starting to see this as a problem and actually vocalize it. As opposed to when I first was bringing it up, people were like, yeah, like we got to go, add this killer feature. And now it's like, this is a real problem. And even other companies that are working to make a living in the Selenium space are also really trying to make that happen too, bring more education to the people, so to speak.
Awesome. And that's one reason why I really love your book. I like how you said there's a lot of information out there, but a lot of people contact me trying to find out, how do I do something? And there's so much out there, but it's so hard to find a central place that you can point them to. So it's great having a resource like the Selenium Guidebook where I can go, pick up this book and, you should be able to get most of your questions answered, at least get you started. And that's also why your book is great. It covers things that aren't normally in a Selenium book. Like, I love your chapter on automating the test runs about continuous integration with tags. You have a great discussion about tagging, and that's actually something my company is struggling with now. So it was kind of cool to see that in there. So I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really interesting because I do think that I've read a lot of different books that covered pieces of this, but there's no one book that crosses all of those concerns. So I guess I was hoping to go for that. Plus, I know that I'll forget something because I put new information in my head and I'm like, I know I wrote this down somewhere. And now I have like, oh, I'll go open up my book and I'll go, I know that thing. I think it's in chapter 16. It's like, and the other thing was before I started writing the book, I also started doing a weekly free tip newsletter, which I still do. It's elementalselenium.com. And that one, that was kind of the litmus to see, is this something that's of use to people? Because I felt like there was a lacking set of examples. I mean, the truest distilled form, aside from something that covers all of the topics like you just mentioned, but actually just saying this, like file upload, how do you deal with file upload? And it's like, which is like one of the most commonly asked questions in Selenium. And I'm like, oh, well, that's actually not that hard to solve if you want to do it this way. And so I wrote it down and then I was like, wait, well, what about file download? And then I kept going. And then I put it out there to the community. And I went from basically having like 50 email addresses like 9 months ago to about 1,200 now. And so I was like, I think people like this. I think this works. Because, the open rate is pretty high. I mean, like 40% of people that get this email open it every time. And so then I was kind of like, well, that's really cool. Maybe they'd really benefit from a book. And I had been following a lot of product entrepreneurs who talk about writing books and having different business models. And personally, I'm trying to get away from selling my time and try to offer something more valuable that can scale to more people more quickly, just in terms of getting the information in a better vehicle to get it to people. So that's ultimately how the book kind of came about.
Very cool. So now I know you answer this in the book, but I get asked this question all the time, and I'm sure you do also. What programming language should I use to develop my Selenium scripts in? How would you answer that?
So I it's really interesting because the short answer is figure out who's going to own it. And have a conversation with them and see where their interests lie, what their skills are, and go from there. The reason why I hesitated was I'm just thinking through this conversation I had last week with my current client because we had this conversation. Like my book is basically unfolding chapter by chapter at this client right now, and so I said, who's going to own it? They're like, well, the developers are, and I'm like, well, you guys are Java developers. Do you want to do it in Java? And then I proceeded to make the case for Ruby, and then they said, all right, let's do Ruby. So now I have a bunch of Java developers doing Ruby. Which is like, I felt like I just wanted to high five myself because I was like, yeah, Ruby all around, always a good idea. I mean, I think that a programming language is just a means to solve the problem, and there's different, and when it comes to something like the oddball problem of full stack testing, it's not like one is really better suited than the other. And in terms of actually solving the problem. I think it comes back down to it's really a human problem where it's a matter of can people accomplish things in a reasonable amount of time and feel like they can, you know, is it something that's approachable for more people than just like, you know, super technical folks? And that's why I think that like Ruby or Python, personally Ruby, just based on my experience, is a great language because it's very readable and it's easy to pick up quickly and grasp some of the concepts, and you can go, you know, pretty advanced if you want to. But ultimately, that doesn't matter. It really depends on the team and who's going to own it and who's going to work with it.
No, I completely agree. I would love to use Ruby or Python, but I think it's amazing you were able to convince developers, Java developers, to use Ruby, because in my experience, there's always been a lot of pushback with that. And I can understand the resistance, but...
Yeah, it's funny because that's actually the second time I've done that.
Wow, that's awesome, because I'm in a large company, and even our company, you know, they have C# developers and they have Java developers, and they're using behavior-driven development. So they want to stay in their IDEs, and they don't want to have to start another language or go into another IDE. So we have a framework for C#, we have a framework for Java, and I've been trying to push, hey, we should have one framework in Ruby or Python that both teams could leverage, and we'd save so much time. But you know, there's just so much resistance. I think that's so cool that you got two teams to actually go with Ruby. So you're doing something right.
Yeah, I'm hoping that if I just provide good enough examples and that the value is clear enough, like, well, I have a whole book written in Ruby. Don't you want to use that?
Right.
Yeah. So maybe my goal, I guess, secretly is get everybody doing testing in Ruby.
Cool. Very cool. I see a lot of teams developing their own frameworks from scratch, and I know you mentioned this in your book also, that there are open source frameworks out there, and that team should leverage that. So, you know, what kind of frameworks do you recommend that are out there? For example, I think you said you mentioned Chemistry Kit. Is that a framework you created, or is that something you helped work on?
Yeah, it's one I created with the help of Adam Goucher, who has two different frameworks. He has one called Saunter, and he has one for PHP and one for Python. And him and I have very similar, I guess, constitutions around and opinions around testing practices and opinions that we want put into a framework. More or less. In my book, I mentioned a bunch, and I'm still trying to find more because I think there's some languages that aren't represented. But basically, within a good deal of the blessed languages for Selenium, like JavaScript and PHP, Python, and Ruby, there are open source frameworks that actually kind of fit the bill of what I think it makes a good framework. And there's a whole host of things that go into that. But, you know, the ability to tag your tests so you can do filtered runs based on, metadata that you want to apply to your tests. That's important. The ability to do, you know, capture good reporting that works with the CI system. That's important. And like, the list kind of goes on from there. Because there are test runners, but I think some people mistake those for frameworks, like testing frameworks. I think there's more nuance to a testing framework. And these are kind of built based on the problems that test practitioners realize and face and then they solve. So I would say the language decision should be influenced partly by the framework if you want to go with one. I think my leanings over the last year, having actually been paid to implement my open source framework for clients, I actually am now trying out just helping clients build their own frameworks. From scratch, like a real lightweight, lean framework, because I think that the leanings that teams have, there's a reason that everybody wants to build their own framework, and I'd rather not try to convince them that they shouldn't. I'd rather help inform them of how they could make a better one. Otherwise, what I've seen happen is I see people implement a framework, and then they don't. Kind of, they try not to use it for how it was intended to be used, and then that's where like some odd things kind of happen, and then there's odd behavior, and then it's hard to track down. And what I think is easier is just put in a bare bones system and make it so it's easy to extend it, and then just help educate on really good test practices and test patterns and how to write your tests in a good way.
So Dave, what would you say are the main elements every automation framework should have?
There's really only like four or five elements to to building a really rock solid framework. It's like, you know, test parallelization, reporting, a simple command line wrapper, and then, you know, cloud execution. And then you're kind of like, okay, it scales. And then you just have to make a place to put your tests and your page objects and then make sure that you use those concepts. And then everything else is like tertiary in my mind. Work with the fact that there's going to be change in different contexts for every single company. There's always something different. And so rather than try to build that into a universal framework, which is what my original ambition was, that's what Chemistry Kit was intended to be, was kind of this simple command line runnable, awesome thing, Rails-like generators that just, you know, worked with Sauce Labs and all these other providers and pulled in assets and rendered this amazing HTML report and does all that. But then it's like, it's a lot to maintain.
Right.
And everybody still wants to build their own framework.
Right,
so,
right.
So that's my take on frameworks is, I think at this point, I'm not abandoning Chemistry Kit. If anything, I might break it apart more and create smaller modules that would be reusable for for companies that would potentially want to just use parts of Chemistry Kit. And then Chemistry Kit as a whole could just be a showcase for what all these sub-libraries could do. And that's kind of my angle, at least.
Yeah, it would be nice if we had there was a Ruby reporting class, you know, we can import from Chemistry Kit or something. That would be
yes.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that's actually something that's probably top of my priority list would be, if I were to break it apart, it would be the reporting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, what would you say makes for a good automation test? What do you recommend making to make Selenium tests maintainable and less brittle?
Oh man, that's such a good question. The easiest thing would be use a page object, like create a class that represents a page and store the elements for that page and the behavior for that page in that class.
Mm-hmm.
And then reference that in the test, and then it's reusable across tests. And then if those tests break because of a locator change, you can just go in one place and update it. That's the easiest one to kind of control the chaos and the change. The other one I would say is write atomic and autonomous tests that set up and tear down their own data, if you can, because they'll not only be a lot easier to run down issues, ghost to the machine, but they'll also be perfectly set up for doing parallel test execution when you want to scale and grow your test suite.
So, you know, along the same lines, this is I guess this is one of the benefits of being a host. I can ask questions that I want to know. Is that we run tests in our continuous integration environment, and you know, how do in your experience, are there any tips or secrets to running and managing tests in a CI environment? Because a lot of times tests are failing, but they aren't real failures. They're more errors where, you know, it's not something that you're verifying that's failing. So, do you have any tips to like manage your CI environment, so like when a test does fail, it's a real failure, and that developers really are, you know, on top of that?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I guess in terms of you're trying to give feedback, trying to build a feedback loop for your team to give them useful information. And so if the CI server is kicking back errors that aren't necessarily related to test failures, or the test failures aren't actually indicating some sort of issue, I would assume that it's probably like, I would say it's worth investigating and identifying and resolving, because I view CI setups as kind of just a pipeline. There should be mechanisms that set up the test runs for success. And what I mean by that is, if you have to have a deploy action to a test environment, that deploy at that point, you then have a decision you need to make that you may not be aware of, which is you need to have some sort of action that can verify that the deploy has succeeded. Either have to put that verification action within the script that's doing the deploy, or as a preamble to your test harness, either in some sort of shell execution or built into the test harness that can assert that actually has finished successfully and is ready prior to running the tests. Because otherwise what will happen, as I'm sure you've seen, like all these tests will run and they'll all error out, and then you go look at it and it's just noise.
Yep.
And then you just run it again and they're fine. And so I think it's a matter of bulletproofing the process of, you know, unit integration test run, and then it deploys. And then it's then something has to happen to make sure that, okay, it's ready. It's like the same thing as you'd want to make sure it's ready before a human looks at it, right? And so then I would also say that once you get into the acceptance testing territory, starting to think about potentially code promotion, where you can say, okay, we want to have a real simple set of tests, like our I use in the book the idea of shallow tests, which is Adam Goucher's approach, where he says critical tests are, think of it in terms of depth of water. There are shallow tests, those are the ones that are at the surface that are really, really important, and then there's the ones that are more deep that can take a long time to run, that they may still be important, but they're not as critical to assert that the app is fully functional from a critical path perspective. And so you could have your shallow tests run initially after a deploy action, and then if those are good, then you can trigger something else. That either could mean code promotion to a manual testing environment, or it could mean kicking off another test pack, which would be these deep tests or some subset of those deep tests. And so as long as if you can work out that from just a system perspective to give feedback in a reasonable life cycle, then I feel like then that's exactly why you need to have a CI server. And if it doesn't do that, then that should be how it should work in my mind.
Awesome. Great advice. Is there one thing you see over and over again in your consulting gigs that most people practicing test automation are doing wrong?
The one that comes to mind is probably not the one that you might think of. But this is something that I'm working through with my client right now. Actually, I have a meeting with them this afternoon to discuss it. I think the thing that I've seen every team struggle with, not that they get it wrong, it's just that they aren't getting it right yet. It's that to do test automation well, I view that kind of as kind of like the human body in a way. If you have acute neck pain, that's probably not to do specifically with your neck. It's something to do probably in your shoulders or your hamstrings or something further down. And I view test automation, like if you're having challenges with test automation, that pain may be systemic from something further up the value chain. And so what I get brought in to do a lot of times is implement test automation. But what I end up doing is a lot of agile coaching, where I then sit in on a planning meeting and go, oh, wow, that's really painful. You guys do this every sprint? And then no wonder you can't identify clear success criteria to figure out what to automate. And then you go, well, why is the planning meeting challenging? And then you go back up and you're like, oh, it's because there's this interesting communication of how things get followed down and they become very prescriptive. Or maybe value's not clearly articulated, or maybe it's just a misunderstanding, or maybe they're not using mockups as well as they could, or maybe they're a distributed team and they have communication challenges. And then all of these things funnel into a challenging issue, or even like an absent business owner, whatever it is. And then it's like, well, you really can't do automated testing well because you can't identify valuable things to automate. The other one I would say is automation for automation's sake. So these two go hand in hand, where teams want to just automate everything. And this includes legacy or regression features, as well as new functionality that's being built. And it's like, no, you really shouldn't do that. You need to discern where the business value lies and really start there. And because you 100% code coverage is pointless, because it's still not going to it's a farce, because it's probably not going to get you what you think. I think you could really focus on 20% of your app, which you could identify based on the actual business value and how does the business make money and how do users actually use the app. And then from there, figure out what to actually focus on first, and then write. But to do that, you have to have a clear, and this comes back, it's the same problem just from both sides. It's like, you need to have a clear understanding of what the business intent is and how people are using the app. And so from a regression perspective, that's just, digging into data and having conversations. And from the feature side, from new feature development, it's like making sure that good requirements come in. And that, I mean, requirements is often, I think, the thing I see people get wrong. And I think also not having a clear understanding of business intent across the team, and understanding that is what ends up happening, is you have people kind of, at least in planning meetings, kind of quibbling over implementation details. And it's like, well, but this isn't, you don't really have understanding of what the outcome is you're trying to test. So we can't really identify success criteria. We're arguing over whether to have this be a drop down or a slider. And that's not really you know, and that's not going to help you figure out how to do this stuff well.
Awesome. Now, to get away from discussions about implementations, you know, I saw a video where you gave a presentation about BDD. So is that something you recommend to clients to help them get out of the weeds, to really talk about behaviors maybe that they want to do before they actually start coding?
I think that that method of communication is important. I don't know if the implementation of doing a BDD framework is actually advantageous. What I would love to see is just people getting in a room and having a conversation and, you know, understanding what users are impacted, how they're going to use this, like what needs to happen and what the actual outcome is. Like, very much like this, there's a great TED talk by a guy named Sinek, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but he has this talk about why, how, what. It's like what motivates people, and or like how great leaders inspire action. And basically, a lot of people start with the what, and that's like thinking about team, you know, a proxy product owner comes in and says, this is what we need to build. That's the what. And people sometimes might just take that and go with it, but for the most part, I think people are inherently resistant to that and in some capacity. And I think that if you start with why you want to do something, how you think you can get there, and then what that looks like, that's a very different set of behavior flows that fire through the brain that lead, I think, people to understand and ultimately influence the potentially the how and the what and make a better outcome. And in order to facilitate that, I think something like BDD is really useful because it gives a simple vocabulary to do that. You know, a simple framework around the idea of given when then, you know, given a precondition when an action occurs, then this outcome should happen. And it's very similar, I think, to like user stories, like as a blank, so I can blank, then blank or whatever. Some teams have had great success with doing, you know, BDD automation, taking and using something like Cucumber potentially in Ruby. And I think SpecFlow, and there's one for every language pretty much now, but I've also seen people have real challenges with it. In my a couple clients ago, I helped them implement Cucumber, and the majority, so that was brought in to do BDD and test automation, and it was extremely challenging and took a very long time to do both at the same time. And so I would say, what I'm trying to do now in coaching my current client is say, we need to find a way to get all the representatives in the same conversation who have some sort of stake in this. The people building it, the people testing it, the business owner, you know, et cetera, and say, let's have a conversation. Let's get everything out on the table, make sure everyone understands it, forms a common language around it, so they refer to things in the same way, and there's no misunderstandings about the word usage, and use whatever means necessary to communicate that. It could be mock-ups, it could be whiteboards, it could be, you know, bulleted lists, whatever, and then after that, distill that into a concise document that has that. And ultimately, that's your success criteria then. And then, oh, wow, you can really identify how to automate that. And if you then at that point, you have a decision of how you want to proceed. You can do something like a BDD framework, or you could just use a simple, you know, set of test scripts to do the same kind of thing.
Excellent. Yeah, great. Some great points you mentioned. So, you know, what I like to think about is a lot of the stuff is just good old fashioned communication. You know, I think a lot of us, like, because we're techies, you know, we're geeky, we want to automatically jump to a solution or a tool, where what you seem to be saying is just getting in a room and just having conversations probably would solve, you know, a majority of your issues before even getting into, you know, coding or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, this is something I fight in my nature as well. It's this feeling like if I just get started and go quickly, then I'll get there sooner. But if I actually delay action and think about it and deliberate, that it may feel like it takes longer, but it's a lot less waste and ultimately probably faster by the time I'm done than going about it the way I usually do.
Right.
So
excellent. So, Dave, are there any resources or books you would recommend to help someone to learn more about test automation?
I think that there's a couple good books. David Burns he maintains the Python Selenium bindings. He has a Selenium book as well. His examples are written in Java, and I know that a lot of people have asked for Java examples for Selenium when they found out my book's written in Ruby. And so he has a book, Selenium 2 Testing Tools: A Beginner's Guide, I believe is what it's called. It's available on Amazon and all the other book. It was a traditional publishing book. I started looking at Java for Testers, which I think was a book you recommended. I haven't gotten all the way through it, but it looked like it was a good read just to kind of help people kind of get into that. Because I know one of the big pieces of feedback that David got for his book was he didn't teach people how to be a programmer, which was outside the scope of his book, but something I tried to put into my book, which was a real daunting challenge to do in one chapter. But I think that if you do Java for Testers and his book, then I think you'd be in good shape. It depends on your skill level and experience with Java.
Excellent. You know, two good resources. I definitely agree. Java for Testers I love because it really is more like a primer before you even get into Dave's book, because I know if someone's reading Dave's book, they'll start seeing things about annotations with JUnit. And, you know, as a developer, that's something you know about. But, you know, if you're a tester that's trying to get into test automation, you may not know about it. So that's why I really love Java for Testers. So,
awesome. Yeah, I think that's a good 1-2 punch. And then the other book I would say has not much to do specifically with test automation, but it has to do with the things I mentioned, how it's communication and such. There's this author, Goiko Atzig, and his name is spelled differently than it sounds a little bit. But he has the big book that I constantly reference, which I think is lesser known by a lot of folks. It's Bridging the Communication Gap. And specifically in that book, the chapter on specification workshops. And that has a lot of amazing kind of process and tactics for basically what I described, getting everyone in a room and ironing out these details and just working through logistics of how to facilitate something like that and make sure it's useful use of everyone's time.
Excellent. That's so funny you mentioned that book, because my last interview with Lance Kind, that's the book he recommended also. So it seems nice. Like there's a pattern going.
But anyway, yeah, awesome. I'm glad someone else gave props to the book.
So before we go, what's one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their test automation? And let us know the best way we could find or contact you.
Sure. Well, I think that there's two things. The best thing you could do tactically is, if you're not using page objects, figure out what those are and start using them. That'll make your tests immensely better and immensely more readable and much more maintainable. And in terms of something that's a little bit softer, that's actionable, I would say try to understand, you know, if you don't already know this, how your business how it makes money or generates value, and identify like critical things that users use in the system that match this business value, and see if you have automated tests that cover it. And if you don't, add them, and you'll be thanking yourself later after you've avoided some catastrophic emergency release. And in terms of finding me, I'm on Twitter. At TourDeDave, TourDeDave. And my website, davehefner.com. My last name is spelled HAEFFNER. And that's my blog, and that's where my book page is. And I also have my tip newsletter, elementalselenium.com. And I also run, and I do a lot when I talk about it. I'm a co-organizer of Selenium Hangout, which is an entirely online meetup. And there's a Twitter handle for that, Selenium Hangout on Twitter. And that's those are the gists of things. And I'm also on the Selenium IRC chat channel, which if you buy my book, you can figure out how to get access to.
Very cool. All right, Dave, thanks again.
And, all right, thank you.
Speak again, thanks.
Yeah, cheers.
Thank you for joining me on Test Talks. If you like what you hear on Test Talks, go to iTunes, subscribe, give us a rating, and hopefully a 5-star review. If you're cool enough to do that, I will give you a personal shout out on an upcoming episode. And remember, you can find the links to everything of value that we talked about today in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/2. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.